Hello, Jean Shaw here, and today I'm chatting to Lee McIntyre, who's made quite a name for himself for his hype-free internet marketing products. Lee took the internet marketing world by storm in 2007, and since then has produced several amazing educational products. His no-fluff, no-nonsense guides enable real people like you and I to take action and get rapid results. Lee's companies Get More Momentum and Aim Higher Marketing reflect his core message, which is how to use honest marketing to build profitable internet businesses in record time. Today, I'm trying to discover how he achieved so much so quickly and whether anyone can model his success. So, Mr. McIntyre, are you there?
I am, Jean. Thank you very much for having me today, and I'm looking forward to sharing some good content with your listeners.
It's a real pleasure. So, you went from being an overworked high school teacher to a full-time marketer in just 56 days. Is that correct?
It is, yeah. And back in the day when I used to be a teacher, I used to love my job, but I never really actually used to enjoy being an employee much. I didn't really enjoy taking orders from people and doing paperwork and all that kind of stuff. And yeah, after I started my internet business at lee-mcintyre.com, it was about 56 days later, after starting that business, that I quit and became a full-time internet marketer.
Mm-hmm. And you started with eBay, which was a bit of a hobby to start with, was it?
Yeah, that's right, yeah. Basically, I've always kind of had like a bit of an entrepreneurial streak, and I've always really kind of aspired to the whole idea of owning my own company when I was younger. Even when I was a teenager, that was something that was always in my mind. And then a few years ago, I just decided that I really wanted to go ahead and take the plunge and just do something, but I didn't really want to kind of invest a lot of money up front. I didn't really want like a bricks and mortar business that was very tie-in either. I wanted something that I could just do in my spare time, kind of keep with my full-time job and then just do a little bit of work in the evening, that kind of thing. And I just stumbled across eBay one day. I actually looked around and saw that there was a few other teachers like me who were also selling teaching resources on eBay, and they seemed to be doing quite well from it and making a little bit of money. So I saw what they were doing, kind of liked the kind of model they were following, and just decided to take the plunge and go for it. So it was literally about a 48-hour window where I first came across the idea of kind of replicating what they had and selling my own teaching resources on eBay. 48 hours later, rather, I had a store up and running. I was making my first few sales, and things started moving forwards.
Mm-hmm. And did I read somewhere that you created 10 new products a week?
Yeah, they were at that time, we were really churning out products. So the products weren't really information products in the sense that many of your listeners will be familiar with. They weren't like ebooks or videos or anything. They were actually just kind of standalone resources that teachers would use in the classroom. So a good example is when I first started that particular shop, it was literally just all the stuff that I had on my pen drive at the time. Resources that I'd used myself in the classroom, so things like worksheets and PowerPoint presentations for the classroom, stuff like that really. So generally what I was doing is every week as I was creating new resources as a teacher for my job, well, I'd go home in the evening and I would commercialise those resources. So I'd just add like a footer to them, I'd spruce them up a little bit, add a little bit of extra information to them, and then create a listing on eBay. So generally I was, yeah, between about 5 and 10 new resources I'd create in the classroom each week, and pretty much all of them I would list on eBay and they'd be for sale by the end of the week.
You see, many people think that they've got nothing to offer, but anyone with experience in anything has got something of value, haven't they, for people with the same interests. As long as you know a bit more than they do, you've got something to offer, haven't you?
Oh, I totally agree with that. I mean, at one of my previous workshops, I was speaking with a lot of the attendees at the bar and having a few drinks, and a lot of them were saying that they didn't really feel like they knew a lot about a particular topic and they couldn't really decide on what niche to go in. And when I got actually deep with them and was asking them a few different questions, it was really interesting where their passions lied and the amount of information they had on their particular passion. A lot of the people I spoke to had loads of information, but they didn't actually recognise it themselves. And the point I always try and get across to people is to become an expert or perceived as an expert, you don't need to hold a PhD or anything like that. You just need to know more than 80% of the population on that particular topic and then be confident talking about it. And that's pretty much the route to becoming an expert and selling information products on a topic. And the really exciting thing is that with the abundance of information available to us now, anybody can become an expert on any topic in just a few days' time and then have some value that you can share with other people.
Mm. I know one crazy thing many, many, many years ago, probably before you were even born, actually, I used to go to evening classes because that was in the days when there weren't any computers. So we used to do shorthand and typing, except that shorthand was much too complicated for me. So I did a form of writing called Pittman script, which was speed writing. And I used to go to an evening class on a Monday evening to learn. And then because they were short of tutors, they asked me if I would teach on a Thursday night at a different venue. So I used to go on Monday night to learn something and then teach that same thing on Thursday nights. And everyone thought I was brilliant, but really, I only just knew a bit more than my students. And so the fear was that they would ask me something that I hadn't quite learned yet. So that is just proof of the pudding that you only just have to know a bit more to become what is perceived to be an expert.
Well, I mean, that's a really interesting story, and I've been there in the classroom before as well. I probably shouldn't say this, but I've had some lessons when I've been teaching A-level studies and been learning the topic about 10 minutes before the class from the textbook, and I've been teaching it to the class, so probably shouldn't tell you that story, but I can kind of see where you're coming from there for sure.
Yeah. I assume, I mean, your teaching background has obviously served you very well, in as much as that you should have possibly prepared lesson plans and things at school. And I always noticed, I used to be a teaching support, and I used to notice that the teachers that had prepared their lessons always were able to control the class much better. But you must notice a big difference teaching now to how you were in school, because especially if you were teaching older students, because they weren't necessarily wanting to hear what you had to offer, were they? Whereas now your students actually pay to hear what you've got to offer.
That's a really good question, and it's a really good way of looking at it. When I was a teacher, I used to teach GCSE and A-level, which is 14 to 19, and the school I was at, everybody had to do business studies as like a default subject at GCSE, because it was like a specialist school, and I used to teach business studies and economics, which basically meant that the whole year group had to study business studies, and many of them resented that fact because they just didn't want to do the subject. They had no interest in the subject, but they were forced to do it as a GCSE. So teaching those classes was more challenging, but as a teacher, I used to really pride myself on having like really good classroom management and making sure the classroom was very organised and disciplined and all that other stuff. But for me, it was all about just making sure that the lessons were really well prepared and really good fun, and where people would walk into the classroom and really enjoy themselves, but within a really strict boundaries as well. So it was very, very different to teaching marketing. Like when I was a teacher in the classroom, people would have to line up outside, and if they had no pen, it would be an instant detention, and they'd stand up behind the chair. And this was all in like a pretty rough comprehensive school, but that was just the way I liked to run my classes. And then once we had that kind of authority and discipline and routine and structure established, then we'd do the fun stuff and we'd have a really good time doing it. Whereas now when I'm teaching at conferences and workshops, it's a very different environment. One of the insights I have is when I'm teaching at the workshop and I look up, I can see a room full of people all making notes, looking very excited, looking very enthusiastic. But when I was a teacher and I used to look up, I'd see half the class not looking quite as excited as when I'm at a workshop.
So you don't get any flying aeroplanes around the room or anything anymore, Ben? Paper aeroplanes.
one of the things I actually found hard is when I'm at a workshop and people are talking at the back of the room. When I was a teacher, I would never stand for that, because I used to be really firm and I used to be massively huge on discipline, and I would always expect like the highest level of behaviour. Probably most people listening to this, if they're familiar with my marketing, might not expect that, but that was the approach I always took. But when I'm in a workshop now, if I see someone talking at the back of the room, I have to really fight my instincts not to start shouting at them and send them out of the room. That's a challenge, but that's what I'm trying to overcome.
You always sound so terribly enthusiastic when I've listened to you doing your videos and workshops and things. Were you the same in the classroom?
Yeah, I mean, I like to think so. I think I feel a bit big-headed when I say that, but I like to think so. I mean, when I used to be a teacher, I used to try and always be really well prepared. I'd spend a lot of time prepping the night before and the week before and stuff. And I used to always try and make my classes very different and very exciting and just very innovative. And it was kind of like a two-tier approach. I'd always make sure that when the kids walked in the class, they knew who the boss was and what the rules were, and that the boundaries were very clear and explicit, and that they knew what would happen if they crossed those boundaries, and that was very consistently applied. But then they also knew that as soon as we got in, we got settled and we got going, that we'd always have a fun lesson, and that would be full of different types of tasks. So rather than me teaching from a textbook, I would generally try and teach with examples, and we'd always bring in a lot of different props and like do silly games. But it was always in a very, very strictly controlled environment. And you kind of get that kind of control and discipline and structure just from really just having those expectations very, very clear, and then making sure that you apply them consistently and making sure that people know exactly what happens if they breach them. But yeah, I always try to be enthusiastic, and even now with my marketing, I always try and come across as enthusiastic. But sometimes I don't even try, or sometimes I don't even think I'm being enthusiastic, and then people comment that I am being. So I think it's just if you're passionate about your topic, it's easy to get kind of animated and get kind of excited, I guess.
Well, this is it, and you're very engaging. When you choose a niche, if you're online, obviously it helps if you've got an interest in the market that you want to give information on, isn't it? Otherwise, you can't be animated and talk about it. Do you feel that?
Yeah, that's a good way of looking at it. And I think the other side of that as well is, if it's something you're not really passionate about or not really interested about, it's harder to produce content. Plus, it's not as satisfying as well when you achieve results. If I'm in a marketplace and I'm teaching people to train the dog, for example, I'm not, but if I was, and then I'm getting testimonials from people saying, oh, this is fantastic, I've just trained my dog, that's probably not going to be that satisfying or rewarding for me. But if I'm in this marketplace and I'm training people how to build their online business, and then I get a testimonial to that effect, I find that a lot more motivating as well. I find that really encouraging. That gives me a bit more juice to do a little bit more marketing myself. So, yeah, I totally agree. You really need to be in one of the big money markets, is my opinion, one of the bigger niches where there's more money. But you also need to be able to choose one of those markets that you feel the most passionate about and where you can offer a unique insight. And if you can be one of those markets and you can get excited about the content, making material is just so much easier. Whereas if you're making material about a topic you're not that interested in, it can become a real painful slog. And you don't want to be making content about a market for the next 10 years of your life if you hate the subject.
And also, if you're in a market which you are involved with personally, you're very much in a better position to be able to bring some of the personal insights into your information on your blogs and your Twitter comments and things, aren't you, rather than if you're just making it up, because people could see through you, can't they?
Yeah, totally. And I mean, giving that kind of personal insight is something that can really add a lot of value to your marketing as well. Like when I first got started at lee-mcintyre.com, I would frequently post a little bit of like snippets from a personal life, little bits of stories from here and there. I remember when I first started doing that for the very first time, my subscribers used to get really excited by it. I took pictures of my home office. This must have been about July or August 2007. And up until that point, I'd never even shown a picture of my face on the internet. So I was showing pictures of my home office, and people were getting really excited about seeing this. They were thinking, God, this is Lee's office, and this is Lee's life. And then I showed a picture of my bike one day, and they got really excited by that. And then I told a story about how I'd been to the football. And every time I gave a little bit of information about my personal life and how that related to my marketing, people really kind of resonated with that. So whatever marketplace you're in, yeah, if you're passionate about it and you live it yourself and you can share that kind of information with people, then that's very, very valuable. And just as an example, I'm actually working with a client at the moment who's in the organic food niche in the UK, and she actually lives and breathes organic food, and she's got an organic food business. So when she tells personal stories and stuff on her blog and via her email list, people really resonate with that, because she can say about the different food she buys at the supermarket and what food she doesn't like, and she can weave in personal stories as related to the topic, and people can really find a big connection there with her. So it's very powerful when you give those kind of personal insights away.
And that's the kind of thing that you would find on Twitter. Are you still big with Twitter?
Not so much, and I mean, here's my reason. My business has grown loads over the last year, and it must have been about a year ago now, I made a conscious decision to really try and cut back on my workload, because for the first 2 years of running an online business, I did work, you know, quite a lot of hours, and I achieved some really good results, but my work did increase. And about 2 years ago, I made a conscious choice to really try and minimize any work that wasn't adding a significant amount to my bottom line. And Twitter, I really believe, is one of those tasks. It's fun to do. It can make you some sales, but it's never going to really help me get to the next level at the stage my business is at now. So for me, Twitter was something that was easy for me to abandon in the short term, because if I don't do Twitter, I probably save about 3 or 4 hours a week, but it doesn't really have any impact on my income. And then I can use those 3 or 4 hours to spend time with friends or work in my business in another area or go to the football or whatever. So for me, Twitter is more of a distraction than an income generator. Not for all businesses, but certainly for my business. And I know that's probably different to what most other marketers teach, but for me, it's probably not the thing that I would recommend people concentrate on the most.
I must admit, I'm on Twitter and I've got several followers, but I've never specifically followed anybody. I've got it set up somehow so that if people follow me, I automatically follow them back. But don't ask me how I did it, because I did at one stage. I think Dave Gwidnon did a showed me how in one of his videos, and I did it. But I don't use Twitter. I think it's a waste of time, personally, or waste of my time anyway. And the same with Facebook and forums. I'm not really into those at all, although it seems to be that the way the most successful people run their internet marketing business anyway is to have a blog and incorporate Twitter, Facebook and YouTube. So is that what you do?
Yeah, I mean, there's a good way of looking at it, and Twitter and Facebook and all those other sites can be a really good way of kind of spreading your message around the internet and getting your information out there. But for me, I'd rather just focus on the fundamentals. And I mean, even having a blog is something that I like to do, and it helps me make my money, definitely, but it's not an essential, if that makes sense. So if I was really strict with myself and I had to strip everything back to the bare bones to try and minimise my work but maximise my income, I would really focus on just the basics, which would be a squeeze page, and then building my email list, and then having lots of products for sale, and then having a back end of products for sale. And I'll just focus all of my time on getting people into my squeeze page. Having a blog does help me add more subscribers and make more sales and build relationships with people. And then having things like Twitter and YouTube and so on helps me get the blog message out there even further into the internet. But if I could focus on just one thing, it would be building my email list. And if I could focus on two things, it would be my email list and my blog. But Twitter and Facebook and all those other sites come way down the list for me. So it's just a case of really deciding in everyone's business what produces the biggest results. I think sometimes we have a tendency in this industry to kind of let our work life become bloated and let our internet business become bloated, where there's always so many different things to try and so many different fads that we just add them on and we bolt them on and we do a bit of this and a bit of that. And before long, after a year or so, everyone is doing everything and you never really have a lot of time to not do all those different tasks. So right now in my business, I'm really big on just getting rid of a lot of different things to try and minimise the time spent working.
So is that why you're a bit cynical about certain gurus who promote certain products which offer or suggest that they will produce fantastic results and don't actually live up to their expectations?
Yeah, totally. One of the things that I've come to realise over the last few years is I've got no problem in my business making like an offer every day for a whole month, as long as the offers are actually going to help people achieve the result and as long as they're ethically and honestly presented. I probably don't make enough offers to my list as I should do, to be honest. But one of the problems that I had with like so-called gurus and the offers that they make sometimes is a lot of the times, a lot of other marketers don't really believe in the offer they're presenting. So you might get somebody who doesn't really believe in Twitter, doesn't really use it themselves, doesn't really think other people should use it, but then they might promote a Twitter product. And the only reason they'll be promoting that is because they're going to get paid a big commission, not because it's going to help the subscriber. That's the kind of attitude which doesn't really resonate well with me, doesn't really fit with me. If there's a particular tool that I've bought or that I think would help my subscribers because of the stage they're at in the business and I really believe that it will deliver a result, then I'll promote it all day long. But when people promote products that they don't really believe in and they've not even reviewed or they've not considered using, that for me is probably not the way to go. And you know, you might make some short-term commissions doing that, but you're going to really burn the long-term value of your customer list, and that's never a good thing.
Mm. No, because your subscribers are your most important asset, aren't they? And you have to treat them as real people, because that is indeed what they are, aren't they? And I read somewhere that you treat them as friends.
Yeah, that's the way I try and look at it. And you know, we always get things wrong, and there's going to be times when we make mistakes, definitely, and there's going to be times when we send out the wrong email and we get the tone wrong. But generally, I'll always try and look at it as how can I make money from my email list, but in a way that I'm looking out for their best interest as well. Because the distinction for me is if I make a lot of money today, but that doesn't deliver a good value to my subscribers, then I won't make more money tomorrow. So if I'm getting $100 in commission from a subscriber, I want to make sure that they're getting $200 in value back, because that way they're going to keep on listening to my recommendations and buying my products. So treating them like you would treat a friend is a really good way of looking at it. And if one of my friends came up to me and said they wanted to build an online business and they were thinking about becoming a blogger or becoming a whatever, and they asked me for a recommendation for a training course, I would happily give them a recommendation if I honestly believed that that recommendation would give them good value for money and would deliver value. And I would therefore give the same recommendation to my subscriber base. And a good way of looking at it is, if I wouldn't be comfortable making the offer to my granddad or a friend or whatever, then I wouldn't make it to my subscriber base, no matter how much commission it paid. And that's not just because I want to sleep easily at night. It's good business sense as well, because if I start making dodgy offers, I might make more money today, but within a week or 2 weeks or 3 weeks, then people will stop buying what I recommend.
Mm. Yeah, I'm exactly the same. If I wouldn't give it to my mum, then nobody gets it. It's not that she'd be any good, because she hasn't got a clue about computers, can't even switch them on, but that is the principle anyway. So you communicate with your followers via blog posts, reports, audios, videos and workshops, and you also now do toolkits like plug-and-play systems and processes. Which did you like doing best? What is your favourite way to communicate, would you say?
Yeah, okay, good question. I really like just sending out emails to my list, and there's two reasons why I like sending broadcast emails. The first reason is you get paid a lot of money, so every time I send an email now, we'll get up to 6,000 or 7,000 people opening the email and between 2,000 and 3,000 clicking the link, making a lot of sales. So the first reason is it's quite lucrative for us to send those emails now. But the second reason is I really just like writing the emails, and I really like communicating what's going on in my life. I like giving some marketing tips and advice. For me, that's just quite good fun. And it sounds kind of cheesy and it sounds a bit hypey, but it's really not. But one of the things I do like the most is when I send the emails around about 5 or 6 o'clock in the UK, which is generally when I send my broadcast, I normally would be at home, sat in the garden when it's sunny, having a bottle of beer, sat at the table, writing an email, clicking send. And for me, that's a really enjoyable experience, because I'm giving really good marketing advice to my subscribers. I'm sat in a very serene environment with a dog beside me, having a bottle of beer in the sun with my shorts on. And then as soon as I click send, we start making a sale within like 5 or 6 minutes. I really can't get across how just much fun that is, because when you compare that to when I used to work in an office, and you'd work all week and all day, and then you get paid at the end of the month. When you compare that to sat in the garden in your shorts, drinking a bottle of beer, writing an email, clicking send in the sun, that's a much more satisfying way to communicate with your members, for sure.
Ah, well, you see, that's obviously where I'm going wrong. I don't drink beer. Is that where you get your best inspiration from, then?
Good question. I wouldn't say I get my best inspiration, but I do like to I do like to have a bottle of beer when I'm sending an email sometimes. But I have a free beer limit, so I'm trying never to send an email after 3 beers. I did become concerned at one point that I would go out for a night out and then come back to my computer and decide it would be a good idea to send it a broadcast. So I made sure I locked away my computer before I had too many beers, so I don't do that.
Right. I found it very fascinating to hear that you were quite nervous about your first interview. Why was that? Was it because you weren't in control?
That's a good question. To be honest, I've been nervous about everything I've done online for the first time. Like, a good example is we're doing this interview now. It's like 3:30 in the UK. And before this interview, I wasn't nervous at all. I would sign into Skype, we'd jump on the phone, we'd start chatting, and that would be very routine for me, because I do one of these every day pretty much. But when I first got started, before the first interview, yeah, I was really nervous. I think it was with Graham Cox, and I remember being in a different house where I used to live in the UK, and I remember pacing around the room. I was a little bit, to be honest, I was a little bit clammy. I was very nervous. I was very apprehensive. And it wasn't something that came very easily at all to me. But equally, when I made my first video, I was the same. When I did my first webinar, the same. Even when I sent out my first broadcast, I was extremely nervous. And these are all things that I take very, very for granted now. I guess the message to the listeners would be, there's going to be loads of things that you feel uncomfortable about, but every time you do one of those things and become comfortable with it, and every time you master it, you really expand the possibilities of what you can actually achieve in your life. I was so nervous about making videos and so nervous about making audios, and now I do them all day long, and I get paid very well for doing it. But if I never would have overcome that fear, then I never would have earned the kind of money I have earned by doing those tasks. So pretty much now I always try and set myself a challenge that if something feels uncomfortable, I'll always want to try and do it, because I know that I'll make more money from it generally in the future. And a good example is when I went to Response Dynamite in Atlanta last year, Joe Lavery's workshop. He emailed me on the Monday to see if I'd come out and speak on the Thursday. I'd never done any kind of public speaking before, apart from in a classroom environment, so I was pretty nervous about it. But I agreed, even though I felt hugely nervous by the time I got to Atlanta. I was really glad I did it, because on the back of that, I then organised my first workshop in Manchester in the UK, made loads of money off that event, and developed my confidence, and taught loads of people good marketing, and so on. So yeah, I was really nervous before that first interview, but I was nervous before I did pretty much everything online for the first time.
I think most people are, but it's very important to step out of your comfort zone, isn't it? They say that the best way to face your fears is to face your fears and actually you do it. For me, it's video. I still actually don't like being on video, but I think that's pretty much a female thing as much as anything, you know, the bad hair day syndrome type thing. maybe that's why sort of young 30-ish males are the most successful at internet marketing. I don't know.
Can I just point out that I feel depressed that I've been put in the young 30-ish male category since I only turned 30 about 3 months ago. So now I'm feeling much older than I used to feel. People used to say young 20-something males.
Oh, well, there's nothing to worry about. Although, when you're 30, that's when you have the most muscles and brain cells. So you want to milk it for all it's worth, because it's all downhill from now on.
Well, that's a cheery thought, but I feel a little bit more depressed there, but never mind.
Well, after 25, you lose 100,000 brain cells a day. So I'm 55, so you've got nothing to worry
about. I should say, I did take turning 30 quite hard. Especially when I wasn't very happy at all. And I kept on reading biographies online about myself, where it said a 27-year-old school teacher, because obviously I was 27 when I started doing this. And that made me even more depressed when I read 27-year-old school teacher. And I thought, God, I'm really old now.
The thing is, Lee, it's only a chronological age. It doesn't really matter, does it? It's your mindset, and you don't have to be old just because your age tells you that you're aging.
This is true, but I still took it quite hard.
Oh, just wait till you get to 40. Midlife crisis, here we come. So, well, now that you know my age, it is possible that anybody can succeed online or change their lives, isn't it, if they have the right motivation. And it doesn't really matter how old people are or whether they're male or female, provided you've got the right mindset, the tools and quality information to share, you can change your life and help others while you're doing it, can't you?
Yeah, in terms of like the changing your life aspect, I think there's an important point that I'd like to make. I remember when I quit my job to become a full-time marketer, and I remember like agonizing about the decision, you know, and trying to decide whether it was the right thing to do. In reality, I'd actually already made the decision, but I felt like I had to go through the agonizing process just to make sure that I was doing everything correct, and if that makes sense. And in my head, I knew that I was going to quit my job. I knew I was going to become a full-time marketer, but I did feel like I had to mull it over and over, even though I knew what I was going to do. I felt like I had to go and speak to like family and friends and get their advice, even though I knew I was definitely going to quit my job. But that was a really, really hard decision to make. But changing my life in that way, and that was probably the one decision that's changed my life the most out of anything I've ever done. Changing my life in that way, when I was going through that decision process, I kept on thinking to myself, you know, what's the worst that can happen if this doesn't work out? I thought, well, if this doesn't work out, I'll probably still make some money online, but let's say I don't make enough money. Well, I'll just go and get another teaching job. And then I thought, well, okay, if I can't get another teaching job, what's the worst that will happen? Well, I'll do supply teaching. And then I thought, well, what if I can't get supply teaching? And I thought, well, okay, I'll go and get an office job. And when I kept on thinking to myself, what's the worst that could happen, it didn't actually seem that bad. But then when I thought to myself, what's the best that could happen, I thought, well, I might make millions of dollars, I might have complete financial freedom, I might be able to live the life I've always dreamed of. That upside was pretty good. And the downside was like, well, okay, I'll get a job in an office for a year, then get another teaching job. So the downside really wasn't that down, and the upside was very up. So the best advice I could give to anyone when they consider changing their life in a dramatic way is actually just think about what's the worst that could happen. It's usually generally not as bad as you would expect. And I come across a lot of people in their life who are really stuck in a rut or stuck in a job, and they become really comfortable and too afraid to mix things up. And sometimes I just want to like grab them and say, look, what's the worst that can happen if you go and get the other job? What's the worst that can happen? And I think when you take that kind of mindset, it's a lot easier to make those kind of big changes that can lead to substantial differences in your life.
The thing is, I think a lot of people settle for what they consider the norm, and instead of having their preferred future, they have the default future that, you know, if you don't do anything about it, that's just the way it's going to be. And that is a shame, really, because we only have one life, don't we? And we need to live it to the full and get the most out of it that we can.
I totally agree. And for me, my life, I mean, I'm not sure how many people on the call are familiar with my background, but I did a law degree when I was at university, and then I trained to be an accountant. And then basically I just did a lot of jobs in my early 20s. I would train in one way and then train in another way and then do a different job and quit one job. And up until I was 20, 25, I'd never lasted more than 3 months in any job. And I was never fired. I just used to quit my job and go and try something else because I could never really decide what I wanted to do with my life. But everybody seemed to used to tell me, look, you've done a law degree, now you have to become a lawyer. But my attitude at the time was, look, I enjoyed my law degree, I enjoyed my time at university, but I don't want to become a lawyer. So I then trained to be an accountant. And then just as I qualified as an accountant, people say, well, now you're going to be an accountant, aren't you? And I would say, well, actually, no, I don't want to be. I want to try and see if there's anything else better out there. And I know that's a crazy approach, and it's probably not what I would recommend to people, to go through all that training and quit jobs so often. But for me, it was about wanting to try and find something. I just knew there was something out there better, and I wasn't really happy until I got that, no matter what the short-term pain was. And there was a lot of short-term pain. Like when I quit my accountancy job to train to be a teacher, I had a big mortgage at the time, and to train to be a teacher, I didn't really get paid for a year, so that was quite tough. And then when I quit my teaching job to become a marketer, there's a lot of risk involved. But every time I've done those changes, it's always been because I've been searching for something better. And I get frustrated when I see people who have been stuck in the same job since they were 18. They know what they want to do with their life. They've got a great business idea, or they've got a great opportunity in front of them, but they won't take it because they're just so comfortable. That to me is frustrating, because they'll talk about the changes they want to make, but they will never find the courage to actually go ahead and do it. And I would really recommend, I'd really encourage everybody just to go out there and chase your dreams, because, you know, like you said, there's only people only get one shot at this, and you don't want to look back with regret. You've really got to go for it with all your energy.
Mm. That's really interesting you said that, because the statistics show that the people that achieve the most online are usually the ones that haven't got any qualifications, or not many academic qualifications, because the people that do get the degrees and all the exams and things, they tend to find themselves in jobs and positions which are expected because they've got the qualifications, whereas those that haven't got anything to lose, they're like a free spirit, and they can go off and try different things, because nobody thinks, well, you know, you're wasting your education by doing whatever.
That's a really good point, and I totally agree with that. And for me, when I looked around, like when I graduated from my law degree, pretty much everybody went for the standard career, you know, like go and work in the city and become a partner when you're 30, and then you do this when you're 40, and you do this when you're 50, and everybody just went down that path, and there were very few people who didn't. And to not go down that path invoked a lot of pressure from people around you as well. I remember sitting in a bar after I'd finished my law degree, and I wasn't sure what I wanted to do with my life. I knew I definitely didn't want to become a lawyer. I actually got a job at Enterprise Rent-A-Car in Newcastle, washing cars for the hour, which was pretty grim. And I remember like one of the girls on the course coming up to me in a bar and saying, you know, where are you working next year? You know, where are you doing your training contract? And I was saying, well, actually, I'm at Enterprise Rent-A-Car washing cars. And she thought I was joking. And I was like, no, I'm serious. And she was horrified. And people on my course were horrified, because they couldn't understand why I would make that choice. But for me, it was just about trying to find something better. And I can't even tell you how pained it would be for me to be in a 9-to-5 job. When I used to work as an accountant, I used to get into the office at 9 o'clock. I would be bored stiff before I even sat down. I would work my backside off for like half an hour. I would look up at the clock expecting it to be like 4 o'clock, and it'd be like 9:35, and then I would just feel in pain. And then I'd get to like 9:40, and then 9:50, and I remember just absolute mind-numbing pain. I could never do that. This is much more comfortable for me.
I think you'll find a lot of people identify with that kind of scenario, when they just go in and they just live for the weekends, don't they? The thank God it's Friday type attitude, which is such a shame, because when you're doing something you really, really enjoy, you'd never know what day it is, do you?
That's a very good point. And like for me, I remember having like doom feelings on a Sunday. I don't know if many listeners can relate to that, where you get to like a Sunday at like 6 o'clock, and all of a sudden you become filled with like a doom feeling, like a horrible weight in your stomach at the thought of going back to work the next day. I used to get that all the time. And in the evening, I'd be thinking, oh God, I've got to get up and go to work. In the morning, I'd wake up and think, oh God, I've got to go to work. But I never have that now. Now every day is a weekend. Doesn't mean I don't do a lot of work. I do loads of work sometimes, but I don't draw any distinction between a Monday and a Sunday. I might take a Monday off, or I might work on the Sunday, or I might work on neither, or I might work on both. I just don't draw any distinction, and I never feel like I'm working. It always feels like good fun. Like next week I'm going to Tuscany for 10 days or so, and I've like hired a farmhouse in Tuscany and made sure it had internet connection, and I'll probably spend most of the day out and about visiting Florence and Pisa and going to the coast, and then probably do like an hour or 2 hours work in the evening. But for me, it doesn't feel like work. It feels like just a hobby. It feels like good fun. And I think if you can get that kind of thing in your life, where when you are working, it feels like a hobby, and that even when you go on holiday, you feel like you want to do a little bit of stuff, I think that's a great place to be, because then you're just doing your hobby for a living.
That's great. And you've now got a team working for you. Not a huge team, but you've got people that are involved with your new projects and things. So do you make it fun for them?
I try to. That's the idea. I'm making this call now from the office in Newcastle, in Cramlington in Newcastle. And in the office, we've got Mark and Lindsay, who deal with like customer support and administration, and they work downstairs in the office. We've also got James, who works in Portsmouth. James has been with me for now for like 2 years or maybe 3 years now. But he works remotely from Portsmouth on the south coast of England, and he just checks in by phone each day. So there's three members of the team plus myself. And then in the Philippines, we've got two programmers as well, one called Mark and one called Joseph, and they do like the technical bits and stuff for us. So that's the team, really. And then we've got other contractors and stuff. And yeah, we try and make it a fun environment. But the real thing is we try and hire people who take a great deal of pleasure from the results that we achieve in the company. Like James has been with me for 2 years, and he would view every result we achieve not as my success, but their success. And that's the way I try and position things as well.
So how did you recruit your co-workers then? Were they subscribers to your list, or did you advertise, or what?
Okay, good question. Well, James actually was a subscriber, and the story with James was I was actually looking for a copywriter to write the sales letter for Standing Start Profits, which was my main site at the time. And James actually approached me and said that he would write the sales letter for me, and he wouldn't charge a fee, he would do it for free, which was a nice offer, so I accepted that, and he wrote the sales letter. He didn't do a very good job the first time he wrote it, so I went back to him and said, look, I know you've done this for free, but I really don't like it. Is there anything you can do with it? And he wrote it again completely from scratch, came back to me, gave it to me. I plugged it in, and I started making more sales immediately. So then I went back to him and said, I really appreciate you doing that for me for free. I'd like to offer you a job as a copywriter. So he came and joined my company that way, which was a really nice way to have him come and work for me. And he actually started doing about 3 months, he wrote copy for my company, until I got to the point where I just thought it would be much better for him to be like a marketing assistant and doing more of a general role, and we moved his jobs around a little bit. In terms of the other people, Mark in the office downstairs was also a subscriber. He actually lives locally to the office, and when I moved my office to Newcastle, when he found out where the office was and he realised it was just next door to where he lived and he'd been a subscriber for many years, he actually just came and knocked on the office door and said, do they have any jobs available and could he help out in any way, and so on, and ended up hiring him from that. And Lindsay, we placed an ad on monster.co.uk, which is like a UK job site, just for a general administrator, and she responded to that, and that's how we hired her.
That's good, because a lot of people outsource or outtask, or they would like to, where the concept is great, but the reality can be an absolute nightmare, can't it? So what is your criteria for not doing something yourself? I mean, some people say that if there's something that is done repetitively and doesn't require you to actually think, then it could be, and probably should be, handed over to somebody else. But if it requires your voice, then you should hang on to it.
Yeah, good question. I mean, what I've tried to create in the company now is any task that needs to be completed to make the company continue to run, I've tried to give to somebody else. So any kind of daily task I need to do, that might be refunds, shipping, paying the affiliates, cancelling memberships for continuity, upgrading memberships, organising workshops, anything like that, any kind of task that has to happen every day, I want other people doing those tasks. And the reason is, like when I go on holiday next week to Tuscany, I probably will do a little bit of work when I'm out there. I will take my Mac with me, but the kind of work I want to do is like fun stuff where I'm growing my business, you know. Like the kind of stuff I'll probably do is I'll probably take like my flip camera and record a video from by the pool and upload it to my blog and stuff like that. But I don't really want to go on holiday and be sat around processing refunds or shipping DVDs or anything like that. So any kind of task that has to be done without me, if I wasn't here, then I want other people doing it. So that if I go away on holiday, the business still continues to run. And that's kind of the main criteria that I apply for that. The way we do that is every task, the first time we do it, we write it down how to do it. And then when a new team member comes on, we literally just give them the manual. So like when Lindsay came and joined, we just said, okay, this is your job and here are all the manuals. And we literally gave her a massive lever-arch file full of instructions on how to do every different task in the business.
Oh, that's brilliant. And do you keep a daily journal yourself? A lot of people do, don't they?
No, it's not something that I would probably ever have time to do, or not something I would ever really do. I've never really kept a diary or a journal or anything like that. I know a few of my JV partners do, but But it's not something I've ever really thought about doing, to be honest.
The documentation thing is a very good idea, though. Where did you get the decision to do that? Was it from some information you received, or was it part of your teacher training, or just was it just something that you thought would be a good idea?
Well, actually, I remember reading the book called The E-Myth. I'm not sure if you've read that, but it's by Michael Gerber. It's a tremendous book, and it's like $10 on Amazon. It's very cheap, and it's just a really good book. And I remember reading it about 2 years ago, and Michael, during The E-Myth, tells a story of, I think the main character is called Sarah, of how she started a bricks-and-mortar business, and all of a sudden she felt completely overwhelmed by the day-to-day tasks of the business and felt entrapped by the business. When I read the book, I was like, oh, my God, that's me. Because at the time, I was trapped. I was doing all the customer support, all the refunds, and I could really relate to the story. And basically, the book's all about how most small business owners get trapped by the business and they can never take any time off and so on. And it really gives some strategies to overcome that. And the strategies are all about creating documents and processes. And that book was a really good book to give me the idea about what I needed to do. It didn't really go much into detail. It just gave me the kind of overview. And then from there, really, I've just trial and error, basically, and tried different things and different strategies. And the position we're at now is that when we hire a new team member, we literally have a manual for every single task that they need to do. And we also have a spreadsheet called the Super Operation Task Manual, I think it's called. And on there, it has the person's name, and they have a list of tasks that need to be done daily, weekly, monthly by that person. And then next to that list, it will also have the manual number they need to reference to do that task. So like when Lindsay joined, it might say, answer the support desk, cancel the memberships, check the voicemail, ship the products. And then next to it, it would say, for this task, see manual P47, and then she would look in a file for page P47, and it would say, okay, number one, log on to Google, number two, do this, number three, do this, and it literally just a step-by-step instruction for every single task she needed to do. And what that really does is the advantage is it gives us scale, so that as new members join our team, we can just give them the manual and spend like an hour training them on how to use the manual, and they can be up and running immediately. That's a very nice feeling, because it gives me peace of mind as well. Like different people do different tasks, and like say Mark is off and then James starts approving blog comments, for example, I don't need to then go and speak to James and say, James, if anyone leaves a link on the blog, make sure you edit it out or make sure you delete the spam. I don't need to do that. I just need to give him the manual, and it's already in the manual covered. So it gives me peace of mind that task has been done correctly as well.
Brilliant. And so what's next for you then? You seem to have achieved a lot. You've produced loads and loads of products and things. Your teaching colleagues at your own school, are they aware of your success? And have any of them joined your lists?
That's a good question. Of the teachers at my old school, only a couple of them actually knew what I was doing at the time. And the reason was I really wanted to keep everything kind of like hush-hush. I was really nervous about actually walking into a classroom one day and finding the kids watching one of my videos on my blog. That was something that used to keep me awake at night, and I was worried about that for a long time. So I only told a few of my colleagues, and they're still aware of how well I'm doing, obviously, and stuff like that. But really, I don't talk about my business much at all, like offline with friends and family and stuff like that. It very rarely comes up, you know. And I think like when I speak to subscribers online or when I get interviewed, people imagine like my business is like a big topic of conversation, or people are really impressed by it, but it doesn't really work. Like I don't like to show off or brag, and I never really want to talk about how much money we're making in our business with anyone, or I just generally like to keep it very private, so it's not something that I generally talk about very much, if that makes sense.
So you're not planning to go back to your old school on the kind of open days where they have people come in and talk about careers and things, so that the old students will know that Sir has become an internet marketing legend?
That's a good question. I know like some of my partners have done that with their old jobs and they've gone back to their office, but that's something I wouldn't really like. And I don't really like the limelight. I know that sounds kind of strange because of what I do online, but I'm not really big into that, really. It doesn't really come easy to me. I just feel dead uncomfortable. I'd feel like a bit of a show-off if I turned up at my old school and started telling everyone about how successful I was. I really wouldn't like that, so that's probably something I'll pass on for now. But in terms of what I'm planning to do over the next few months, the last few months have all been about trying to work a lot less. So I've really created a situation now where I can get away with doing 1 or maybe 2 hours work a day, so like between 5 and 10 hours a week, and the business will still function and still grow. And that's been for a lot of hard work and dedication in terms of hiring the right people and creating lots of manuals and stuff. And I'm really pleased with that. So the last 6 months have not been about making more money. It's just been about making more time for myself to do different things. Now the next 6 months is going to be about still working only a few hours a day and then really ramping up the profits as well. I feel like we've got to a good point where if I'm not here now, apart from maybe 5 to 10 hours a week, we'll still grow. But over the next 6 months, I want to only be here between 5 and 10 hours a week, but grow much, much faster. So that's the kind of plan.
That's amazing to think that it all started off as a bit of a hobby, isn't it? So it's really inspirational, what you've shared with us today. And I'm sure the listeners will get a lot of inspiration to realise that if they just take the first step, they can get their desired lifestyle instead of the default one that we were talking about earlier. And even if it just starts off as a bit of a hobby, I mean, there's people make a fortune from like knitting, isn't there? And growing tomatoes and things like that, because everybody has a skill. But the thing is, because they do it on a day-to-day basis, they assume that everybody else is equally as qualified as they are, don't they?
Yeah, totally. And I remember when I first started my online business, writing Classroom Management 101, which was like my first kind of teacher niche ebook product. And I remember writing that in the classroom at lunchtimes. And I remember like sometimes it would get too loud with the kids playing around outside and stuff. And I'd jump in my car and go to like the local retail park, and I'd start typing my book up on my lap, on my laptop in the car park, and I'd drive back to school. And never in my wildest dreams did I then expect I would be here now in a massive two-story office with a team of people around me, making more than $1 million in sales every year. That just didn't even cross my mind. So for people listening now, if you've started something, or maybe you're about to start something, and you can't imagine this level of success, then, you know, I would say I can agree with you, because I was the same. The stuff that we achieved in our business, I never imagined that I would ever do workshops teaching people about marketing. I never imagined I'd travel to Atlanta to speak at an event, or to London. I never imagined that any of this stuff would happen. And it started from such simple beginnings, just sat in a classroom at lunchtime writing an ebook, and not even having a clue how to format the ebook, having to learn how to even make a PDF. I didn't even know how to make a PDF, let alone how to make a website. And from there, within 3 years, we've got to here. So, I mean, if I can do this, then anyone can.
That's right. And if you could do it in 56 days, you never know, you could put a challenge on your blog. Can anybody beat my 56-day record? So how can people find out more about you, Lee?
Okay, good question. Probably the best place to go, I would say, would be getmoremomentum.com. That's GET, moremomentum.com, getmoremomentum.com. If they go there, they'll just find loads of free videos and articles and audios and other good stuff. And I'd strongly recommend you just go there. And it's just my blog, my new blog, and loads of free content. And you'll probably find probably about more than 30 hours worth of videos and audios and training, and keep you busy for a weekend at least, going through loads of good stuff. So if you're interested in starting your own online business, go to getmoremomentum.com and just enjoy.
Okay, well, that's absolutely brilliant, Lee. Thank you very, very much once again. So as he just said, you can go to getmoremomentum.com, and I'll also put a page up about him on jeansbestrecommendedproducts.com. So once again, Lee, thank you very much, and bye.
Thank you, Jean. I appreciate it, and I'll speak to you later.
Okay, take care. Bye.